the theme for the afternoon talk is the benefits and the limits of feelings. Feelings. In the exploration of the inner life, the Buddha once made a response, it may not be precise with the Pali here, but that life comes or meets together with feelings. And the significance and the importance of feelings in life is significant, we might say quite profound. And there is a tremendous range and depth and presence of a whole variety of different feelings. And I can't think of any texts, modern or traditional, which, so to speak, dives into the world of feeling so much as the Buddha has done. It's clearly a very important area in his life. It's addressed in a whole variety of ways, which the way it affects our thought, our speech, our movement, our life, and sometimes hardly known to ourselves, let alone to others, the way that the feelings are impacting in a whole variety of regions. What I'd like to do with you this afternoon is to touch upon some of those areas, keeping in mind, as always, one's own experience, and look at that both from the value and the presence of feelings, but also from the place and the point of limits as well. And initially, with the value of feelings, lots of situations in the day-to-day life, contact with ourselves, contact with others, contact with environments and situations, we might often initiate the communication with "I feel." I really had a good time in this place. I really enjoyed myself. I'm not necessarily speaking about Eindor here. Or I really had a difficult time. Maybe speaking about Eindor. Teasing. I'm really not sure how I feel about being here. So we're interested quite naturally in the outcome of what we say and what we think about how we feel about people, places, situations, and that certainly includes ourselves. So we're consistently introducing a dialogue into our life about feelings. And this dialogue yet falls, shall we say, into the expression, and we do need to be extremely clear about this, expression of the pleasant feelings and the whole variety of range of pleasant feelings, joy, happiness, love, kindness, gratitude, generosity, warmth, calmness, peacefulness, tremendous variety pleasant feelings, which we acknowledge, and the response to that, those feelings, can be more feelings, because this is how we feel and we respond well. There's the other range of feelings as well which arise, and we might go from the unpleasant to the painful. And sometimes you say, "Oh, I don't like this. Just feel this is not working for me, this is not helpful. I really had a very painful time with this person or with this place or with this situation." And in those kind of feelings, the range of those feelings can be very wide, from very, very painful, if we speak of depression, if we speak of despair, feeling suicidal, feeling desperately unhappy, to feeling a little bit upset, feeling a bit dissatisfied, feeling a bit annoyed. So the range of feelings for a human being between the pleasant and the unpleasant, and somewhere in between. Somebody might say to you, maybe even one of us teachers, how do you feel? Or your therapist, if you have a therapist. And you may say, well, I don't feel particularly pleasant today, I don't really feel good today, but I can't say I feel unpleasant or painful or bad today. My feeling is somewhere in between. And Buddha has given clear acknowledgement to that kind of feeling, which is certainly hard to describe, but we wouldn't say it's a pleasant feeling, but also we wouldn't say it's an unpleasant or painful feeling. It's kind of somewhere in that range in between. And in the feeling life which arises, there are bare feelings, whether we're, as I sometimes say, the Buddha of the Buddhas, or just Joe and Mary blogs out on the street, that there are the range of feelings which arise. And part of our exploration in the feeling life is to see what else connects with those feelings. That's the beginning. What connects with the feeling? And what connects with them will affect significantly, noticeably, demonstrably, a lot. I forget the word. Demonstrably. It will impact a lot on the feelings. So, as an example, miracles occur and one has a deep meditation. Really feels deep. And there are tremendous depths of meditation. Deep happiness, deep joy, rapture, bliss, delightness, sweetness, deep equanimity, a depth of inner peace. And the pleasant feeling has become associated in that time with the depth of mindfulness, of concentration, samadhi, of interest, energy, often, not always, silence and stillness. And when we put all of those factors together alongside and giving support to the pleasant feeling, it will have an impact upon the pleasant feeling. And the outcome of the pleasant feeling is it just goes deep. It's almost gravitational force. It just takes us deep. And Dharma teachings have wisely encouraged that kind of approach. One of the beloved Dharma teachers, Shaila, who was here last month. And when she returned from Israel and gone to Gaia House in Devon, and she and I spent the afternoon together, and she is wonderful teacher, has written a very fine book as well, on the power of what's called jhanas, of deep meditative states, to really be well established in happiness, natural happiness, in calm and joy, natural calm and joy in the being. And there are practices which really give support to that. It's an indirect advertisement for her retreat, I know. And in that, when we have that calm and depth and natural happiness in us, and we can feel it in the body, heart and mind, one of the important aspects of it is our demands on the world world means people, places, knowledge, things, goods, etc., goes down proportionately to the depth we experience. When we actually begin to see through the combination of more inner calm and depth there, that happiness is not actually out there at all. That, whatever it is, cannot make me happy. If what out there could make me happy, my gosh, the world would be the happiest realm imaginable. These goods, this place, this person, this situation, this job, this wife, this child, this husband, this lover, this being without a lover, whatever. If I had whatever made me happy, then happiness would be the norm. But we know it's social fiction, it's a mythology, it's a self-deception. So in the realms of the pleasant feeling, when we feel that more deeply inside, almost quoting the Buddha here, when there's greater depth inside, then the hindrances called wanting, called negativity and blame, called boredom, called restlessness, anxiety, called fears and doubts, all of which are strongly associated with unpleasant feelings which have built up. So when there is greater calm and depth in the being through our experience and through our practice, there is less experience of greed, negativity, boredom, anxiety, worries, fears, doubts, etc. That actually gets less for us. And more important, one begins to feel and sense with that a greater sense of course, being at peace with oneself, but equally important, being at peace with life, being at peace with the world. And that sense of being at peace with has the pervasive thread running through of a pleasant feeling. Having said that, generally speaking, to be human, which is always not always the best idea, but we have to deal with what we got, that the general wish of a human being is to have far more percentage-wise pleasant feelings in life than unpleasant ones. Most of us, we are deeply interested in the maximization of the pleasant and the minimization of the unpleasant and the painful. This is called being human. There. But it's not quite, as we all know, in the area of choice. If it was a choice, a free choice, which is what we get told, another mythology, if it was choice, then naturally I would wake up every morning and I would say to myself, today, I think from morning to night, I've decided that I'm going to experience unbroken, ongoing, continuous, without interruption, pleasant feeling. No matter what. No matter who amongst you I talk to. What the state of the rooms are like. What else do we go on about? Whatever it might be. You know, if we had a free choice, then the initiative would be 100%. I mean, why have any unpleasantness in life? 100% pleasant feeling. But choice do not seem to go so far as to guarantee the continuity of the pleasant. Life doesn't seem to take too much notice for us. The unpleasant we often can't think of a good word about it. I spoke with you this morning, the unpleasantness that arises in the pain. The unpleasantness arises when the unpleasant feeling has attached itself. It's got hooked onto a particular story. The unpleasant feeling that arises around a small incident, whatever it might be, and we're shocked by the incident, or we're afraid of the outcome of the incident or what might happen. So there's the unpleasant, there's the difficulty of the event. We grasp hold of it, and the unpleasant feeling feeds into the event. So it starts off, something is unpleasant, a situation, a thought, a bit of a story, and we ask ourselves, why is this drama, this melodrama, this soap opera, this nightmare, why is it increasing? And I'm not realizing that I'm grabbing my feelings about it and feeding them into the event. And as I feed, they build into catastrophe, into volcanic eruptions, into emotional tsunamis. And I haven't realized that I've grabbed the unpleasant, which is maybe the fact in the beginning, fed more and more feelings into it, like putting petrol on the fire, and think it would help to put the fire out. And so then our life becomes this intensification of drama, the emotional drama, the story drama. And if you take the event and then the feeling life pours in, the thoughts pour in, the memory pours in, the future pours in, whoa, this is war, internal war, different forces all clashing and colliding there, and the poor old self inside, the I and my, knocked around one way and the other, splattered we are by internal events. And therefore, in the wish and the interest, it is to look and to say, does the unpleasant feeling, if I didn't have a story, a drama, a crisis, a terror of the future, a problem of grief and loss and separation and sorrow, the anger, I can't get what I want, whatever, would it be that in my unpleasant feeling, if it wasn't associated with the problem of my mind, like I described, the hindrances, and as one of the teachers says, sometimes we have the multiple hindrance attack, all in 1 10-minute period. Greed, hate, boredom, dullness, agitations, fears, doubt, confusion, anxiety, worry, the whole catastrophe. Whoom. Boom. Would there be any unpleasant feeling left if it didn't pile into the drama? If I didn't have the drama, therefore there would be no unpleasant, and then life would be just the kingdom of heaven. Day in, day out. It's a nice idea, not a chance. The unpleasant feeling can be born from different directions. Touched upon this a day or two ago. Sometimes it's in the cells. Hereditary, genetic factors. But one of the very important aspects of the unpleasant feeling in life without the hindrances is that in life sometimes you and I, we experience something as unpleasant, but it's not that we're angry or worried or upset, we just experience it as unpleasant, And from that unpleasantness in the feeling and the perception of the situation, whatever it might be about, it is the spark, it is the initiative for action. Most meaningful action in this world, most important action in this world, has actually come from an awareness of the unpleasantness or the painfulness of it. And I say that both from the inner level and from the outer. In the famous story of Gautama, not the Buddha. The Buddha started under the Bodhi tree at the age of 35. At the age of 29, he was not the Buddha. The Buddha is the one who woke up. When he hadn't woken up, just the guy Gautama, that at that point, at the age of 29, clearly he was going through a difficult personal crisis from the words in the text. And the crisis reached such a point inside of him that he couldn't cope with the three major responsibilities. No hierarchy. One of them, the responsibility of the father of a week-old child called Rahula. Secondly, the responsibility of a husband to his lovely wife Yashodhara. Thirdly, the responsibility to succeed King Suddhodana, his father or lord in those times, there as a successor when the father died. And all three just weighed heavily upon him, because he was besieged with terrible doubt. Is this what it's all about? Just fulfilling duty, etc. And there was a crisis there. He'd seen for the first time in real terms in his life aging, sickness and death, and saw a yogi on the quest. And he said he fled home. He fled the palace due to the strength of these unpleasant feelings that he couldn't cope with. He literally ran away, as he said, in the middle of the night. And it said in the text, he was in such turmoil when he ran away, he couldn't bear to lift the cover back of the newborn baby in case it stopped him. He just ran. And that unpleasant feeling, for some, it drives away in terms of quest. But to his credit, on realization, within months of seeing his five yogi friends, he was speaking with Rahula and Yashodhara, and actually since after that became a very responsible father. There's plenty of examples of statements in the text. Sometimes something touches us strong and deeply, and one could say many of the organizations, groups, networks, foundations and trusts concerned with human life, concerned with animal life and environmental life, the initial impact is something is unsatisfactory, it's unpleasant, and we need to take some steps. And small groups of people come together on the shared, this is unsatisfactory, this has to change, or it has to stop, or something has to be done. And therefore, to repeat the point, the unpleasant feeling in life has a major, significant, supportive role for existence. A vital feeling, and it is not the Dharma teaching to try to maximize the pleasant, which is what social, corporate, business, private sector, whatever tries to do, and minimize every way possible anything unpleasant. The Dharma says there is the pleasant in life. What happens when we're in touch with it? There is the unpleasant in life, what happens when we're in touch with that, And what happens in those kind of feelings for us, which are somewhere between the two, how to respond? If we identify with the pleasant, and identifying with is important, as the Buddha pointed out, the identification with the pleasant will easily feed into more wanting and desire to re-feed the pleasant, reconnect with it, to have more of it. And when we do that and we keep doing it, the pleasant eventually will become the painful. Ask the alcoholic, ask the junkie, ask the one addicted to gambling, ask the person with terrible food problems, ask the situations where one is grasped on to, ask the person who's shopping. There's the pleasant feeling initially, there's the action which is there, and from the pleasant feeling, the action, one secures what one wishes. Keep doing it again and again over the same old thing, whatever it is about, the constant repetition will turn the pleasant into a problem. It didn't start off as a problem having a glass of beer. It didn't start off as a problem having a, what do they call it these days, a joint. You know, so out of touch with the world, that world. It's been a long time ago, I have to say. unlike Bill Clinton, I inhaled. there. But the sheer repetition, the pleasant, because of other factors getting hooked with it, neediness, wanting more, the pleasant ends up painful, sometimes terribly, terribly painful, ruining lives, as we know, ruining friendships, ruining marriages, and of course a lot of violence may even come from it as well. So our practice and part of our exploration is to give equal care and attention to the pleasant feelings of life, really to acknowledge them clearly and quietly, to really acknowledge the unpleasant feelings, and be especially clear what we make of them. What do we do with them? How do they show themselves? As well as that range in between. Another aspect of all of this is the Buddha uses this lokiya lokutara here, and it means worldly and spiritual, and they're both kind of very even-handed. Quite often the view is Dharma teachings are spiritual. Strictly speaking they're not. Strictly they get associated with the spiritual category, or even the religious category at times, spiritual. But it's not quite in the language of the Buddha. And what I mean by that is, in the very down-to-earth, an extremely pragmatic approach to the exploration of life, sometimes the sense of the spiritual is very much alive, very, very much alive, and that can show itself in numerous activities in our life. We have the feeling of life is spiritual. Sometimes you and I have the privilege of meeting people, individuals, and we say, well, this person's such a spiritual person, such a spiritual being, you know, the gods and the goddesses of the earth, the angels of the earth, and it's very precious and lovely to have contact with them. And some of them, of course, in religious life, of course they are, because that's where they feel most comfortable and most at home, in any of the religions there. And sometimes just by the way of life of that woman or that man, it's something quietly spiritual. And their way of life is not one of kind of being single-pointed, having a clear, firm direction in life, and setting perhaps valuable targets and really going forward. And sometimes we meet spiritual people in life, and it also may be in ourselves as well, where just the way of life is quiet, it's conscious, it's mindful, it's quietly caring. Not doing anything special with the life, but something kind of what we call spiritual, some feeling, some intuition, some sense of spiritual people. And the world needs spiritual people. There's the other, which is, Buddha uses the word Lokiya, English translation is worldly, and recognizes, and this is part of the pragmatic teachings, that lots of things that you and I have to do every day are very ordinary, they're worldly. Just getting up in the morning and brushing our teeth and having some whatever, cup of tea and some bread and tomatoes. And now we have some bread this week. It's brilliant news. What's the other so-called month? What's it called? Metta. Yeah, yeah. Right, yeah. When I come, before I arrive, I always think I'm coming in Metta week. I have certain preparation. It borders somewhere between the neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Somewhere in that realm for me. I don't know how it is for you. Anyway, so sometimes in the ordinariness of things, just ordinary worldly things, we brush our teeth, we go to the shops, we buy our food there, we make a phone call, we travel from A to B. And Dharma teachings, it's a feeling, and it's the ordinary worldly feelings. The Buddhas, or Joe or Mary blogs on the street. Ordinary worldly feelings arise there. And just as with two hands, to use the small metaphor for the moment, two hands are valuable, two hands are important. I might use one hand more. I'm right-handed, so I might use the right hand more. If I was in India, I'd probably use the left hand a bit more. Those of you will get what I'm saying here. The deep truth. And so I use the right hand for this, and I use the left hand and for this. But sometimes it's the other way. I think the three teachers in the first retreat were all left-handed. And so I really felt to be in the minority here. And there. The Buddha's Dharma here is acknowledging feelings, as it were, the two kinds, let's say, pleasant and unpleasant, and also to see in my life are the two hands at work. Meaning, does it seem like my life, for some, is all worldly? Just worldly things, making money, the job, the studies, going home at night, looking after the kids, taking care of the parents, or whatever it is. It's just a really worldly life. And if it is, in Dharma, it's a one-handed life. One-handed life. No wonder the Zen dwellers say, what is the sound of one hand clapping? One person very kindly sent me the reply. The reply was, very quiet. Which I thought was rather a good response. Zen master should give you that. So is it all on the one side? Sometimes people are very, very spiritual. Very, very spiritual. But simply haven't got the other hand. They can't deal with anything remotely worldly. Get into a terrible panic about most ordinary little things are so spiritual, almost painful. So we want to look at our life and both have feelings in it. The worldly feeling is a particular kind of feeling. The spiritual feeling is a particular kind of feeling. And the Dharma of exploration, is a Dharma which is respectful and quite clear. This is a worldly feeling, and this is a spiritual feeling. And to look and to say, am I so far on one end, and like a person with one arm? Or am I really developing and cultivating and recognizing the importance of the other? Generally speaking, we know it's mostly more worldly and less spiritual. We know that. But not that doesn't apply to everybody. And that part is part of the dialogue of being able to include. And of course, sometimes with some people, we want to introduce the worldly into a conversation, and they're so spiritual, they don't want to listen. They don't want to hear about football. I don't know why, but they don't. You know, and sometimes we want to introduce the spiritual, and we want to talk about our meditation practice and that deep mystical experience we had some time ago. And it's not, please come on, let's have a cup of coffee and talk about something else. So in the dialogue of the spiritual and the dialogue of the worldly feeling, we also have to know who we're talking to. Are there the voices around that actually can hear? You know, when I, if I may, very small example here. When I returned home after 10 years in the East, 6 years as a Buddhist monk and all of that, and arrived back home and knocked on the front door because I asked my parents not to come to the airport, knowing my good mother, because I didn't want a tsunami of tears from my good mother when I arrived back, you see, because, you know, I didn't want to flood the airport. So I said, please, just I'll come home and I'll meet you when I get home. My father, if you give the contrast here, apart from the years, you know, fighting the Germans, the rest of the time, he never lived more than 6 miles from the house he was born in. It's hardly travelling, is it? And we'd never go out of the country. And even after he and my mother had been away, they'd go on holiday. Poor family, so we'd go and stay with this uncle there, or at the guest house by the sea, etc. And after 4 or 5 days, he said, "Oh, it's boring. Come on, let's get back home." He just didn't want to be away from the whatever the locality there. And it's not like we lived in a wonderful place. The architect, it's a place called Croydon. Never go there, please. Honestly, it's just anyway. It's instantly forgettable. And so when I got back home, I had been away exactly 10 years and 10 days I'd been there. So my father had no interest in religion. Life is, you just go to work, you earn your money, and you look after the family, you have a few friends, you go once a week or twice a week to the pub for a beer. That was your life. You didn't and football Saturday afternoon. That was it. And a little bit on the GGs, as you would say, on the horses when you had a little extra. That was it. That was it. So his son, homeless, wanderer, monkhood, hitchhiking around 20, 30 countries, like, so he never, and some kind of spiritual journey. I mean, he wouldn't even know what the word spiritual meant, my father. Neither do I, actually. So when I got back, he never asked one single word about his son's absence for 10 years and 10 days. And actually, I knew he wouldn't. My mother, father, have a beer. Well, I wish I did. And so I say, sometimes in the worldly life, in spiritual feelings, which are precious and beautiful, and we need to nourish them, they're very, very precious and deeply important, but in the worldly dialogue as well. But in coming to that, I say, as I said at the beginning, there is the range of spiritual and worldly feelings. The Dharma is a pragmatic teaching which acknowledges the value and the importance of both, and therefore to stay deeply connected with what we feel there. However, just two limits. Yes. Having said that, sometimes in the Dharma world, in these kind of explorations, one is at an everyday level for a moment, and one is at the deepest level. At the everyday level, sometimes those people who are regarded as intellectual, academic, spend a lot of time in their thought, scholarly, the research types. In India would be called the pundits there. Often in the meditator circles get a rather bad press. And one of the weapons which is used against such people is they're not in touch with their feelings. So the feeling types, which often come on retreats and other types, but the feeling types will identify with their feelings and say, you know, I'm really in touch with my feelings, etc. And I'm just really feeling my way through this day. Whatever. And then those people who are not quite like that, and they're more academic and thoughtful and scholarly, say, oh, he's so out of touch. It's usually men, we poor second-class creatures. He's so out of touch with his feelings. He's just in his head too much. He's just not connected there. And this is a kind of conceit, in a way. It's a kind of arrogance of the feeling life, of identification with the feeling, and that the feelings matter more than anything else. Having listened, worked inwardly, outwardly, with the dynamics of that, my observation is that some of those who are regarded as being philosophical, intellectual, academic, scholarly, or whatever, have an enormous important role to play. Enormously important. I don't want to live in a world full of feeling types. That, well, it's a world which is diverse. And I know for myself with regard to this, consistently, and hopefully you too, have benefited enormously from the pundits, from the scholars, from those who have written beautiful theses, from those who are very committed. As the Buddha said, the development of the mind, sometimes it's almost an anti-mind view. Oh, the mind is the problem. Let go of the mind. Drop your mind. No mind. You know, all this Dharma language that goes on around our circles. But there's not in the teaching of the Buddha. This is all contemporary stuff, actually. It's we can develop the mind. And what I notice, and having spoken to many over 35 years of teaching of those who are the intellectuals there, that some have said to me, "No, Christopher, you know, my partner says to me, I'm so much in my head, I'm too academic, and knowledge here, and meditators tell me this, I'm out of touch with my feelings, etc." And some have done all manner of things you can't imagine because they believe that there's something wrong in being a scholar or being a pundit. So they've gone on these courses and workshops there, you know, to get out their feelings and shout and yell and scream. And the old days, they used to beat the pillow, that was the one, these cathartic, then, and they gone back to their pre-birth condition and rebirth themselves galore, etc. And they've gone to see their Jungian therapists and their Freudian therapists and their Rogerian therapists. Spent mega money to get back in touch with their feelings, because they're not in touch with their feelings. They've done all that. Years. Spent mega money. And after it's all over, they're still the same. Didn't change anything. And why should it change? Our practice and our exploration is to express acknowledgement and appreciation for the worldly and the spiritual, to express acknowledgement and appreciation for those who are feeling types that we call, to express acknowledgement and those for those who use their mind and use it in a whole variety of ways, all coming back to the question, the core question, is it generating problems and suffering or not? And many of us, and I include myself certainly here, without the scholars who have shed clear light on the text, apart from translating them, have given wonderful commentaries there through tremendous rigour and discipline of intellectual research, most of us, I certainly would be far poorer as a human being without those people. And I think that this discrimination, and it's a nasty one, I find, towards the intellectuals and towards the scholars and the pundits, this kind of patronizing view from the feeling types, is actually missing the point. So, again, opening out the consciousness, being respectful to, and that dialogue between those whose feelings and emotions are strong and those whose thought and conceptual world is strong, that quite often neither can understand each other. Ships passing in the night, sometimes crashing in the night, sometimes like a Titanic crash. One hits the other, and they, I don't understand you. You're in your head. I don't understand you. You're lost in your emotions. They say, whoa. They sometimes get married. Interesting. Why not? All is to be explored. In the looking and the feeling life, in the expressions and the communications of the feeling life. Final, how am I doing? A point at the deeper level of all. This is the extraordinary thing here. It may be in the listening, it may be in the meditation, it may be in reading a book, whatever it might be, that sometimes life touches us. Generally speaking, the touch of life, for most things, will initiate a feeling. You say, oh, I had this wonderful experience. Oh, it's a feeling with association with place or event or experience or meditation. But sometimes life touches us in such a way it doesn't actually land in the feeling realm, but it still touches. To take some important examples of this, listening to the Dharma probably is one of the most classic. Listening to the Dharma, the Shravanas, the great value of the listening. We can listen to the Dharma, and sometimes it touches strong feelings inside, really appreciation, feelings of love and happiness and connection there, which is precious. We can listen to the Dharma, sometimes it's unpleasant, usually because we don't agree, or the teacher isn't connecting with the listeners, we get out of touch with it, we can't follow there. Sometimes we listen, and it, not that it touches the feelings, but it kind of touches the mind. Touches the mind, meaning kind of comprehend what you mean, I get a little idea of what you're talking about. I don't really feel it, but intellectually. And sometimes on the aspects of Dharma, of teachings of emptiness, of the deathless, of liberation, of non-self, of no self, of dependent arising, and some of these key concepts, that sometimes they go over the head, they don't land anywhere. What the hell is he talking about? Well, they go there. Sometimes one hears, but it's, you know, straight out, straight in, straight out, and that arises. Sometimes in the listening, it's, I understand intellectually what you are saying, but it's just not reaching me. I hear with the word, I can understand, you know, I know enough English, I know enough Dharma language, but it's only intellectual. So it's not changing me, it's not giving me any insights, it's not waking me up. And sometimes there's a strong feeling, as I said, of affirmation. But whether it's over the head, intellectual comprehension, strong feeling response, those are responses to that. But to come back to the theme of the benefits and the limits of feeling, it can be that the understanding emerges and there is no real noticeable response anywhere. There's no excitement, there's no energy change, there's no tactile sensations coming out of the body, it's not intellectual, it's not producing lots of concepts. Something's got clear though. Something has got clear. Something's clear. And that which comes clear there, sometimes we don't know at the time. We sometimes have a view that listening to the Dharma or listening inwardly, two areas, let us say, that if something is clear, it's clear in the moment, it's clear on the spot. Well, I listened to that discourse, I was really listening deeply, and then it all got clear. But the inner life doesn't work so neatly. If only it did. I listen, I look, clear, shalom, go home. That it's an organic process. And in the movement of the inner life, in an organic process, sometimes it just emerges, the clarity. And people regularly, if I may say here to confirm the point, write to me, tell me, and other teachers will hear this too, write to me and say, Christopher, I listened to you speak. I was on your retreat. I was in that DFP program. I was at that public talk, whatever it might be. And, you know, I listened, etc., etc. But there's something that you said. And now I understand. Now it's really got clear to me. There. And sometimes they quote me. And sometimes I never said that. But that doesn't matter. Something, I might have said, but I forgot. You know, like one person on the last retreat, she wrote to me a note, and she said, I get really concerned about when you said about absolute truth. I cannot remember ever using the words absolute truth. It makes me feel uncomfortable even saying absolute truth. Well, what's that? Please give me the definition of it. So sometimes, as I say, in the organic life, in just like with nature, just like with the seasons, just like with other seeds, the fruits are organic. We can't put them to prescription. We can't say, I listen, clarity. It takes many events there. And sometimes it all suddenly comes together very, very very, very clearly, preciously, and whoa, whoa, just comes together. And when something is coming together for us, some element of it somehow is freeing us up. And then we know something is coming together because it's freeing us up. And all the teachings are about freeing us up. That's what they're about. And when something is freeing us up, then the teachings is really working well, really there. And that can be here, it can be anywhere. And the important aspect, another of this, is that there is, and I find in my life, a certain kind of receptivity which goes on. And if we're really doing our practice quietly there, the receptivity is there. And sometimes, I know for myself, in the privilege of going to listen to other teachers give talks, all sorts of things, all manner of things, not just the Dharma, Buddhist world, but other things as well. When the receptivity is there, one hears, and even though one might know the theme before, I've heard the teacher before, something fresh and new really, really starts to come in. Just a few months ago, I went to, in our hometown, lots of people come. I missed the word. Joanna Macy came. She's one of the guardian angels of the Dharma. She's 80 years old. Her husband had died just a year before. And she came to Totnes, and the local church was used for the meeting, because nobody goes to church. But not in Totnes, anyway. And so there were about 300 or 400 people. It was absolutely packed out. And, she turned 18. She gave a lovely, lovely talk on her various themes that she likes to do there. And then she spoke to us over the... Joanna loved the long-term view. I mean long-term view. So here we are, four and a half billion years ago. The cells started getting restless. And things started forming and coming together. And how, we started off in the water, and then in the water, she said, we suddenly began to get rather bold and just come out of the water, just initially. So these, initially, were our flippers and our fins, and then got up on the beach there and flapping around with these. People like me are still flapping around with them. I haven't evolved very much. That's what, the only reason I became a meditation teacher. It's one of the few jobs where this is good, you see, because I can't use them for anything much. And then we began to need to hold a tree or something, or pick something up. So then we went from the flippers to the hands, and away we went. And then in the middle of this lovely, lovely talk, very Joanna, I love her to bits, she's such a jewel. She said, turn to the person sitting next to you and hold their hand and feel the texture of the hand. And the first source of that rose in my mind, we don't do that, we're English. But this is Totnes, we can do that. Totnes is the New Age capital, it's alternative, everything's okay there. But it was precious just to feel the life and the sensations and the connections. There's became some nice sharing with the person sitting next to one. So sometimes the feeling life, as they just having the long-term view of Joanna just helps to get our perspective, our small visit to the earth into a kind of long-term view. It just helps expand and open up the consciousness. And small insights like that can feel to be freeing. It's less trapped, less me and my. And more the sense, well, this life is this extraordinary event that's going on there. And now, as I say, our receptivity, a line in what we read, the listening to a talk, a quiet meditation, the looking up at the stars, the seeing of the flower, the connection with the moment, whatever it might be, sometimes can just free up something there for us. And as I say, the opportunity for that is equally available to the feeling types, and it's equally available to the intellectual types, and it's equally available to those who are neither one nor the other. And that's the important thing. Liberation is available to, and freedom is available to, one and all without exception. And that freedom is including the exploration of spiritual life and spiritual feelings, and they are precious and important. And to the credit of religion, the best of religion reminds us of the importance of that. And secular life reminds us of the importance of the worldly life, of being pragmatic, realistic, and down to earth. And Dharma says, be clear about both, look at the feeling life, and sometimes acknowledge the benefits of feeling life, the limits of it, and authentic liberation is the accommodation of both. It's not the sustaining of one type of feeling called the pleasant. It's the embrace and the inclusion of all. And that's a great freedom in life. And that freedom has no death to it. And we're deeply interested in it. Let's have a quiet minute together, shall we?